You're going to love this episode. It's with Dave Van Horn of PPR Capital Management. Dave is the founder of the company, the executive chairman of the board. He has a lot of experience in different aspects of real estate and distressed note purchasing and management, and also capital raising, and just a lot of entrepreneurial ups and downs. And Dave's had a ton of success, but it wasn't always easy, that's for sure. We talk quite a bit in the beginning about Dave's adversity that he faced with his family life when he was a child, and the divorce of his parents, and the splitting of his family. Essentially, his siblings were, you know, half of the siblings went one way and half went the other, and how many of his siblings didn't turn out so well as far as, you know, their success and health. Now they're all doing well, and the siblings all get along. So in that sense, there was a lot of, it's perfect for the, for from adversity to abundance. But we talk about how Dave was a painter, a real estate agent, a contractor, managed a title. He ran a title company, loan originator. I think, you know, when it comes to residential real estate, there's not many, many aspects that Dave hasn't touched. And now they're in the commercial and multifamily space as well. PPR is a big company in this space, in the distressed note space. They raise a lot of capital, and Dave's had a lot of success. I mean, he does humbly mention toward the end that if he were given $10 million today, it wouldn't really change his life. So that might give you some indication of the financial success Dave has had. He's a very humble guy. You gotta have to pull it out of him as far as the abundance and success that he's reached. But this is a very relatable episode. Even if you may not reach the levels he reaches, has reached, I should say. You know, we do talk about financial hardship as well as relationship hardship, and even a health challenge that essentially shut down one of his businesses. So buckle up. This is a really, really good one.
From Adversity to Abundance, hosted by entrepreneur and seasoned real estate investor Jamie Bateman, is the ultimate guide for active and passive investors seeking clarity, mental fitness, and the confidence to make inspired decisions in the world of real estate. With a decade plus of investing experience across various niches and a background as a combat veteran, former Army officer, and multi-million dollar mortgage note company owner, Jamie brings a wealth of knowledge and inspiring stories to each episode. Through weekly episodes featuring insightful interviews with industry leaders and solo explorations of mindset and strategy, listeners will uncover actionable advice and tips to overcome challenges and build lasting financial success. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, From Adversity to Abundance is your roadmap to turning obstacles into opportunities and achieving financial freedom.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Bateman. I'm thrilled today to have with us Dave Van Horn. Dave, how are you doing today?
Unbelievable. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Dave is the founder of PPR Capital Management and also the executive director, and we can get into that later. And I, for the listener out there, I have a lot of respect for Dave. I've followed Dave through the years, and certainly the 5 or 6 years that I've been in note investing space, but even before that through Bigger Pockets and some other avenues. But I know you, you've had a lot of adversity and a lot of abundance in your life, Dave, and we're gonna get into that. So for the listener out there, why don't you drill down a little bit more on some more context as far as who you are and what you're up to today?
Yeah, sure. Like I said, you mentioned I'm executive chairman of PPR. So, you know, I run the board and oversee the CEO. We have a new CEO at PPR. Up until recently, though, I was president and CEO for the last several years. And we just celebrated 15 years of PPR. We were a PPR note company. Today, we're PPR Capital Management. So, been a name shift and a brand shift. And things are good. So, we're excited. And we don't just do notes and mortgages anymore. We also do some commercial real estate as well. So our funds, we have a fund that's real estate backed assets. It's a little more diversified than it was when we started out. So that's pretty much. And I came from the real estate world. Previous to that, I was a contractor. Over the years, I've done several things. I've had various licenses, you know, real estate license, insurance license, was a property manager, owned a title company for a while. So I've done a lot of different things over the years. But in recent years, was mostly a fund manager and ran a company and scaled it and things like that.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's, you know, you're humble. And I think you're selling it short slightly. And hopefully I did say executive chairman, not executive director, but regardless. So talk to the listener about kind of what's the, a little bit more about the size of PPR or kind of some of the funds you've managed in recent years to give them a little bit more context.
Sure. I'm trying to think how many funds have we had since the beginning? 9 or 10, I would guess. I'd have to go look. We have a lot of entities. There's probably 50 entities, you know. We're not a super large shop personnel-wise. We're around 30 people. But we do have some JV partners that have sizable shops as well. So we have a JV partner on the West Coast that has a significant number of people. They also have a trade desk in New York. And then we also have some other JV partners on the commercial real estate side, and some of their teams might be a dozen or 15 people, that kind of thing, with folks that we partner with. So we would probably have more employees, you know, if we did everything ourselves. We may have 150 employees at that point. But as far as assets under management, we're in the, you know, 700, 800 million range. And private equity wise, we're probably just under 300 million. If private equity, but we recycle a lot of that money. So it's a little bit different than, you know, if we were just, say, a commercial real estate shop where, you know, it's kind of like you put money to work and you wait, you know, we're constantly probably on about 75% of our business, the money's moving, you know, rapidly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going out, it's coming back, it's going out, it's coming, that kind of thing, which is a little bit different than, you know, a typical real estate fund that's you know, more, you know, complacent or whatever.
More static.
More static.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. And I know, I remember.
But as far as assets, that's a good question. Most of them today are in Georgia and, you know, we have some multifamily. It's around 1,000 units, mostly in Georgia and Texas. You know, we're kind of newer to the space. But loan-wise, yes, definitely well over 12,000 probably since we started. It's common for us to probably buy about $300 to $400 million a year. We sell a lot of REOs, probably several hundred REOs a year, just to give context. So, sure. and that's Absolutely. Nationwide mostly, you know, to be honest. The commercial real estate's typically in the Sun Belt or high growth areas or maybe a couple tertiary markets, but it's kind of where we're focused and more of a diversification type play.
Yeah. And you, like you said, you moved into that a little bit more recently. And that's one of the things I remember Chris Sevigny and I had you on our Good Deeds podcast a few years ago. And I remember that one of the big lessons I took from that was you said, just tell me what the rules are and I'll figure out a way to win. So I remember kind of what my biggest takeaway was flexibility and adding, you know, tools to your tool belt, if you will. So that no matter what happens with the economy, no matter what happens with legislation, you can react and still profit and still, you know, do good. Hopefully we can dive into that in a little bit. But
sure.
As far as adversity goes, let's jump into your backstory. I know before we hit record, we touched a little bit on a couple of types of adversity that you faced. Why don't you start where you'd like to, as far as, you know, in your history, and we'll pick it up from there.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody has some adversity. But then again, I'm kind of grateful for where I am too, you know, so I feel blessed and, you know, things can always be worse, right? But absolutely. I think we all go through adversity, and I think a lot of life is how we respond to things. Definitely one of the biggest challenges for me, especially growing up, was, I was one of six kids, and my dad left my mom when I was eight. And that was pretty traumatic. You know what it's like when you have, we were blue collar type family, but when you take the breadwinner out of the picture, things go downhill very quickly.
Sure.
And then also my family had gotten split in half. So I had three older sisters and two younger brothers, and our family literally got chopped in half. And, you know, eventually my sisters went to live with my father, which at the time they probably thought it was a good idea, but it was really bad idea. And then their lives were, you know, dramatically impacted. I had one sister that went to prison for, sentenced to 15 wow. years in prison. I had a sister that went to reform school. I had a sister that got, she was a mom very early. You know, those kinds of impacts. Sure. My one sister was, a heroin addict. So a lot of things were negative from that divorce, so to speak. And, I was fortunate to be on the right side of that. A couple of interesting things come out of that was not everybody fares the same way. An impact of something like that, to look at me probably on the surface, you're like, oh, Dave has it halfway together. He's fairly normal.
Exactly.
He's done okay, but not everybody came out of that okay, is what you learn.
Sure.
Not everybody responds the same way.
Sure.
A couple of weird things that happened. One was me and my siblings, we never fight. How you'll see cases where people will, I haven't talked to my sister or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Me and my siblings, we literally, there's no argument. Because I think because we were separated,
which
is a weird dynamic, right? When you think about it. So it's kind of interesting. Now, there was a time period where I hadn't spoken to my father in a good 5-year period. Now, most people can't envision not speaking to their father for 5 years, right?
Sure.
Later on, I was able to actually reconcile with him and basically kind of forgive types of situation before he passed. But the whole time as a kid, though, it was a different road, right? Because what I quickly realized, even in fourth grade, I had my first job. It was you had to do it on your own. There was no backstop. There was no safety net. Now it did give you trust issues, you were reluctant because if you can't trust your parent, who can you trust? That's kind of what ends up happening.
Yeah.
There's weird things that happen that you can't do that normal kids can do. Now, it's different when your parent, I think, passes away because that's like can't be helped kind of thing. It's just a different vibe, than it is in a case of, you wonder, did your parent want you or not? Those kinds of things, and it's just it's a harder thing.
Yeah.
The big one, that was early on that had an impact in everything from my education to my, you had to bootstrap whatever you did,
Yeah. So. Now I appreciate you sharing. I know you've talked on lots of other podcasts about how to invest in notes and how to, and your successes and things. And what we're trying to do is highlight, some of the pain that people go through and to highlight the fact that you can get through it and you can pull out lessons, and not to say you'd like that, if you had to do it over again, that you'd want it to go that way. But sounds like you've developed at least a work ethic and a good relationship with your siblings through that challenging.
Yeah, it's great. And the other weird thing that happened, even though I was like a middle child, I felt like the oldest of the family I was in because of the way it was. And then all of a sudden it's almost like I played a bigger brother, father type role in a way. It kind of that probably wouldn't have happened if the family was all together. You know what I mean? It's sure. just like a, you know, yeah. looking back on it. So it did change some things. Sure. But yes, the good news is everybody's pretty good. And for the most part, today, mm-hmm. But not everybody comes out of that unscathed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I did better than some of the other folks. That's really what it was.
So why would you say that is? I mean, I know there are factors beyond your control, but, looking back, why would you say you did better than the others did?
I mean, it's a good question. I think some people, I don't want to sound bad against my siblings.
Sure, sure.
Some people have more of a blame or a victim yeah. type of mentality.
Sure.
Maybe I had less of that. Right. And then gotcha. I kind of figured things were on my own. And then I had some lucky things. You know, you make your own luck. And I always worked really hard. Like, my mom was a very good work ethic, very mm-hmm. spiritual woman. Mm-hmm. You know, and we, no matter what our jobs were, we did our best, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of mentality.
Sure.
We were always on time. We could be poor, but we could be clean. You know, things like that are just ingrained in you, and you were honest, you were honest and you had sure. integrity and things like that, yeah. even though you didn't have much. So those kinds of things carry forward a lot. And, things sense. Just, you know, I did get fortunate. I was in, I had really good grades. And when I was in eighth grade, my mom kind of conned me into taking an entrance exam to a private school. And I go, Mom, we can't afford to go there, blah, blah, blah. And she goes, don't worry. Just see how you do. You won't get in. Don't worry. Just see how you do. And you kind of know where that went. I ended up getting a 4-year academic scholarship. And that dramatically changed the trajectory of my life, because sure. all of a sudden I was just surrounded by wealthy folks. And it was a very accelerated program. And it got me out of my comfort zone. It was actually in the next state over. It was, out okay. of the neighborhood. It was out of the, the normal yeah. school. And sure. it dramatically changed things, just that right. one scenario,
So. No, and I personally, I don't believe in self-made millionaires or, because we all have some kind of help along the way or some kind of luck. You can, sure. it's, you can debate that all day long. So maybe you got a lucky break there, but at the same time, you had really good grades. So you wouldn't have gotten in had you not done the work in front of you. So, I think there's a lesson in that.
Yeah, it was a combination.
Well.
I mean, yeah, for sure. And then, once I got through there, then it was, all right, how do I get to college? And I'm kind of embarrassed of this, but it took me 5.5 years to get a 4-year degree. But I paid the first couple of years out of my pocket. I went to a state college. I actually had gotten into Drexel, but I couldn't afford to go to Drexel really. I'm from the Philadelphia area. Mm-hmm. So I had gone to a state school in Pennsylvania, which was obviously less. And I had to take out some student loans to finish. But I was trying to pay it as I went kind of thing, which looking back wasn't so bad, but mm-hmm. It wasn't like I was, some of the wealthier kids in school. Obviously, sure. they could study more, or they didn't have to work as much. I was actually working 4 days a week and going to college. So it was wow. that's one of the advantage that I think when I look at my kids and my grandkids, they're mm-hmm. pretty well off. They don't have that kind of adversity, right? To where they
sure.
Have to take out a lot of debt, or they can't, mm-hmm. They don't have to work and then wake up and go to school and try to study and cram. And, life was much harder. In fact, I almost flunked out, which it's kind of ironic now when you look back and you're like, your report card, your bank account when you get older. But
right. yeah,
but you're but when you're young, a lot is meant, what's your degree, what's your
grades,
education level, what's your sure. that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, looking back, it's nobody walks around and asks me what my GPA was, right? But
no one asked me to see my report card or anything these right. days, which is fine because yeah. I don't know that I care that much.
Yeah. So No, I think a lot of what you've said already, a lot of people can relate to. Definitely sounds like you've overcome a lot from your childhood, and you've touched on it. I mean, it's all about how you respond to adversity. So walk us through from college. I know you have a long story as far as all the businesses you've run and everything like that and startups and everything. But walk us through kind of from college through today, highlighting more of the adversity that you've come across.
Yeah, sure. I had met my wife when I was like 19. We've been married almost 40 years. But my my wife had gotten pregnant before I finished school. So it was really tough getting done. And then when I got done school, I couldn't even afford an apartment. You know, I had a business degree, which technically were a dime a dozen at the time. And imagine going to college, taking out loans, working real hard, going for mm-hmm. 5.5 years, you get done mm-hmm. and you can't get a job. And I was, imagine that, right? Yeah. And then I was working in construction. And I couldn't afford an apartment, so I had to move in with my mom. And we were splitting the bills. And it was really grueling. I'd come home from work all, filthy and everything. And one day my mom says, well, why don't you try like real estate? Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I started going to school at night and became an agent. And then it was working towards my broker's license. And I was handy because I had worked in construction and I had access to the MLS, but I didn't have capital. And I was taking an investment course to get my broker's license. And the guy teaching it said, how many people in here have credit cards? And we all raised our hand. And he goes, how many people in here buy houses with credit cards? And all the hands went down. And I remember going home that night and telling my wife, I go, I think we're going to buy houses with credit cards. And she was like, that's not going to affect my ability to go to the mall, is it? And I'm like, no, that's a different credit card. Don't worry about it. And I don't recommend doing this, by the way. So hopefully this doesn't translate like that. But this was prior to cash advance fees and things like that. And what I ended up doing was I would write a credit card check to myself, pay cash for a property, fix it up, move a tenant in, refinance the house, pay back the credit card. And next thing you know, I bought probably 10 or 12 houses like that. And over time, they kept upping my limits. Next thing you know, I had like $500,000 in credit card access. And then I would continue to cash flow. And any money I pulled out on the refi was tax-free. So I was mm-hmm. building some wealth and some cash flow. And then a few years went by. Next thing you know, I had $2 million in equity. And then I ended up being a lender to other contractors. So that's kind of how I got into the note business initially was, hard money, private money, lending back and forth to other like-minded folks like myself. We became, basically banks for each other, using mm-hmm. our lines of credit on our properties and using our qualified plans, retirement accounts.
And I know you do have your book that goes into some detail on all this as well. But did you have any kind of real estate mentor at that time, or how were you before you got into the lending space and just real estate?
I came through a weird place in the beginning because I came in as an agent. And I believe it or not, there were years, it was 1990, I was top agent in the company. And there was like 250 agents and like six offices, that kind of thing. So I did okay. It wasn't, but I also worked as a contractor full time while I was an agent, which was a little bit crazy because I had the wrong, I didn't understand leverage. I thought if you worked harder, if you worked real hard, you did good no matter what. So the more I worked, but you run out of capacity. And I was probably older, 40s and 50s, before I realized it was all about leverage. And it's funny that you say coach and mentor. It was more in my later years. There were many years I've spent well over $100,000 on coaching and mentoring, in the hundreds of thousands. Mm. So most people, it's funny if I speak in a room and I say, how many people in here spend more than $100,000 on coaching? Not too many hands go up. It definitely changed the dynamics, especially when it came to leverage, because my one coach was his favorite question was, what's the one thing Notice he didn't say five things. It's the one right. thing that you're going to leverage that'll catapult you in the next 6 to 12 months in your business life or in your personal life too. And it could even be in, you know, your sports team you're coaching. It could be, mm-hmm. could be any topic almost. Mm-hmm. But there is typically one thing that'll really dramatically, you know, move a needle or 10x or 100x something, mm-hmm. as opposed to a lot of things. And we all tend to get, you know, caught in all the minutia.
Sure.
And absolutely. it was a great mentoring and coaching experience from him. And that was a guy named Lewis Schiff who wrote the book. You know, he's wrote several books, but one mm-hmm. was Business Brilliant, and yeah. he was from Birthing of Giants in New York, and very sophisticated group. I was actually a very small fish in that pond.
So now the leverage specifically in your case was other people's money. Is that what we're referring to that you were able to use?
Well,
to grow?
It can be. At first you think that, you know, capital is definitely something we can all utilize sure. or leverage, but it can yeah. also be personnel and technology and education. Sure. And typically yeah. what will happen is each quarter or each month or something, it could be a different thing, depending where your business is. You know, like, you know how there's like, I like to say there's three pillars to every business, right? There's
yeah.
capital, there's sources of product, and then there's yeah. scalability. And one of them is always screaming the loudest, usually.
Absolutely.
And so those answers can shift, you know, in my mind.
Sure.
So, and I'm not saying you can't leverage a couple things, but usually there's a needle mover that's really going to move the needle, you know, and that's,
yeah.
it's almost like the book, The One Thing. It's, you know,
yeah, great book.
It's that kind of concept of, there's probably one thing that's really going to be dramatic, you know?
Yeah. Like the 80-20 Pareto principle where you're focusing on the 20%.
They took that to another level too. They would do the 80-20 of the 80-20, the 4% rule, you know,
okay.
You're like, okay, I got to really zero in. Sure. I think that type of concept. And then the other one that was real big for me was focusing on what you do best and mm-hmm. getting out of some of the other stuff. And it took me a while because, you know how like we like to all wear a lot of hats and think yeah. we're important and we try right. to do everything. And one of the things I did in recent years was, you know how you take your, whether it's your Outlook calendar, your Google calendar, whatever, it doesn't really matter. Sure. I kind of took that and then I made like three columns and I had, what I really love to do. I would do it almost for free. Gives me joy. You know, mm-hmm. I get great energy from it. You know, I had that category and then I had a category of stuff I can't stand doing. Why am I doing it? And then I had actually the hardest category is the middle, which is stuff that you don't mind doing it. You're okay at it.
Right.
But it really comes down to, should you be doing it? You know, and
sure.
There's a lot of those things.
Time worth?
Yeah. And then it's, you know, you'll hear people say, you know, time blocking and goal setting and all that.
Right.
I don't know. I'm kind of getting to the point where my goal is to not have any goals, or the only meeting I want to be in is the one with no agenda, you know? So it's,
absolutely.
It's funny how that shifts. And what that's really saying, it doesn't mean I don't have goals. It just means, I don't have to.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it makes
a different thing, right?
Makes total sense. I had James Harold Webb was a previous guest and he has a phenomenal story, but we had a call after the podcast and he said a similar thing where, you know, I said, well, should we set another appointment for a call? And he said, you know, I don't like to put things on my calendar these days. He said, just reach out if you need something, you know? And there was a lot of freedom and guess, you know, just.
Yeah. It's like the morning routine, right? Like I was, you know, when I was obviously president and CEO, the routines were very, you know, strict, regimented, systematic, sure. all that good stuff. And in recent times, not that I don't have routines, I do.
Right.
But like, sleep's a real big thing for me these days. Another one is I have like almost like a no alarm clock policy, even though I get up the same time every day, which kind of sounds ridiculous. But I don't really even like an alarm. I mean, I hate it even to catch a plane on airport. And I'm very guarded with time and mm-hmm. phone. Like, I haven't had a phone in my office in 5 years. Like, if you look around, there's no phone. That's you can't fantastic. Really call me. Right? No. So I just,
that's great. You can, I love it. Right, I can.
But you get what I mean. It's like, yes. It's very, and I do have a morning routine, like, you know, same as everybody else, probably with, sure. you know, exercise or reading and writing. And,
yeah.
you know, we all have hobbies. And I'm fortunate. I have two real, you know, grown adult children, two sons, and I have four grandkids and, you know, three nice. Grandsons and a granddaughter. So they're a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know,
no, and I'm sure
you can be a hobby in themselves, right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. But your morning routine, like, sounds like you do that because you recognize the value of that for your life and for yes. others' lives as well. It's not because you're forced to do it.
And I meditate. I'll do yoga once a week, just stretch, nice. And you know, I do nice. Exercising and all that, and I do some intermittent. You know, I like that.
Uh-huh.
I do like coffee. You know,
yeah. Yeah.
But I also, you know, it is tough. Like, I'm not yet the one meal a day guy. Yet. it's a noble goal.
Right. There's always another level.
Yeah, so there's always another level.
Talk to us about, you know, because you mentioned some adversity already on the, you know, growing up and the relationship side of things. Talk to us about some of the other adversity, maybe financial, that you've faced either in businesses or on the personal side?
Sure. I mean, most of the financial, if you really look at true adversity, it was obviously in those younger years because sure, it was more basic, you know,
yeah.
You got to take care of food and shelter and things like that.
Yeah.
Later in life, probably the biggest thing was around the time I was 42, I had a painting company and I had that for, let me see, a good 10 years. And I was, I had hurt my back and it literally put me out of the business. I actually had to sell off contracts. I had to do all kinds of stuff, lay off employees at the peak. And I had 12 employees and, you know, I couldn't load trucks anymore. I couldn't physically work. I wasn't allowed to lift anything over 25 pounds. You know, thank God I had the ability to use my education and my brain. And my real estate background because and at the time I had I guess I had around 20 properties at one point. I had gotten up to like 40 of my own places. And you know, if it wasn't for that, I would have been in a real predicament. But I couldn't you know, do the physical work I used to do, and it definitely, you know, I shifted into real estate obviously, but you know, life had to change. And so I was fortunate at the same time I was having problems with my back, you know, because I would get hurt and I'd be out for days. What the lesson there was, the business revolved around me. Mm-hmm. And then I realized if I ever have a business again, it's not going to revolve around me. And that's kind of, you know, when you see PPR, for example,
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of team behind me, you know, there's
right.
A lot of folks, sure. partners, so, Sunworks here, there's, you know.
Yeah, no, it's also impossible to scale if you're the,
yes.
you know, the only, the key cog in the wheel. But so what did you do tactically at that point then when you started your next business, how did you approach that to make sure you weren't the key player, if you will?
Well, in the beginning, I was an agent, and what I did was, well, I was living off my properties. Obviously, I could do that. And then but I started doing multiple streams of income at first. So I had a title business. I used to, you know, run mortgages through my wife, even. I did property management. And then I focused on investors. So if you were an investor of mine, you might buy 5 or 10 houses. And then, you know, we would do multiple things for you. So I would get paid multiple times, not just the commission to sell you a property. And then I would also be a leasing agent. And then I'd also, you know, so I had this like kind of a snowball effect.
Yeah.
Vertically and I did that integrated. For a while till the crash. And then that's when I entered. Yeah. You know, that's when we started PPR. And we were like, after the market crashed in 07, 08, we were like, all right, what side of the fence do we want to be on? It's going to be ugly for a while. And it really was ugly for realtors for a while.
Sure.
So we were like, you know, my partner, John, was a mortgage originator. He was actually an investor-friendly lender and I was an investor-friendly agent. And, you know, there was just no, I went from at Remax at the time, I was probably doing 75, 80 sales a year, easy, I dropped probably to 7.
You know, so wow.
It plummeted, you know? So yeah. It was a good thing that I did go into distressed debt. Now from another financial adversity though, was one of the parties that was initially teaching us the collection side of the business ripped us off to the tune of several million dollars. And it took a long period of time to go to court. Actually, we got it back, but it was the lost use of the capital that was very painful. And sure. It almost put us out of business.
So the opportunity cost of not having that capital.
Yeah, having the capital was... luckily, we had the skills to continue to raise capital and figure it out other ways. But basically, when someone does that to you, they literally try to put us out of business.
So,
like the bad builder concept. You know how a builder has 25 or 30 subcontractors and their model is to pay no one. And then maybe one or two contractors will sue. They'll settle with one. And even if they lost the case to the one, they didn't pay the other 25.
So it's still profitable, even though
it's very profitable. To them, it's like a business thing, even though it's very unethical. Right.
Right. I don't know how people sleep at night. So tell me, you don't have to go into specifics, of course, but talk a little bit more about that as far as what was the relationship with this person again? And mainly for the listeners.
Someone that was selling us assets and they were, helping us collect on the assets, things like that. And we had put up some money to obtain assets and then never got the assets, right? And they ran out of money. And then you heard a song and dance and all that stuff for a long period of time. And then it was like, sue me. And then suits take years. And then eventually we got it. And yes, we got a little bit of interest, but the little bit of interest did not solve for the impact it made. Right. Yeah. It was pretty devastating, actually.
Sure. The opportunity cost of the money, but also your time and energy. That's
a lot of energy focusing on the legal, the chasing, the, dealing with investors, the whole nine yards, right?
Do you have any lessons learned there that the listener could take away as far as,
yes and no. I mean, you're always, don't wait, right? It's just like if you're evicting a tenant or, a homeowner's not paying, those, the longer you wait, you're just making it worse. And so there's always, speed means a lot. Move quickly, right? Don't wait. There's no point in waiting. I guess I don't know that you can become, say, a millionaire without losing some money somewhere, right? Yeah. I've had other cases where I lost, a $250,000 or $500,000, even on a personal side in investing or something. But I don't think I don't know what the odds are if someone becomes, say, a billionaire who never lost $1 million or something. I just find it probably unlikely, that could even happen, because I'm not saying you want to go out and try to lose money. I don't mean it that way, but I think that's part of the learning piece of it. It's I don't look at it as failure. I think I was just listening to Sarah Blakely was saying something like that when she was a kid that, her father would say, so what do we fail at this week? And he'd high five that kind of thing. And it's because it's a learning experience. It's really not a failure, right? So it's back to kind of what we were talking about with the adversity piece, where it's like, how do we respond to what happened? I know I see my son one time, sometimes he gets bugged at that. He's like, aren't you worried about this in the news? Or aren't you worried about that in the news? And I'm like,
right.
No, because it's how I respond to what, let me see what happens and then I'll make my move. I mean to sound that crazy, but it's kind of like that. I can't worry about what might happen. Now, I'm not saying I don't take any precautions. That would be foolish to say that. But I kind of see what shakes out and then I adjust accordingly.
No, that's a very valuable piece of wisdom, honestly. And that's been a common thread among a lot of the guests we've had on the show, as far as, not focusing on the big picture, meaning the things I can't control, as far as maybe you take that information in, as far as you might use it in your analysis, but not overemphasizing that with regard to your stress levels and what if this, what if that, what if that. What if this, and shifting from what if to even if has been a key piece. But I know for me, you know, years ago, I made a switch and I turned off the news, you know, the cable
news,
network news. Yeah. It's like, and I stopped worrying about all that stuff. And I shifted to, okay, my father was also an agent. He still is, technically. My brother was a loan officer. You know, I had title insurance experience. What are the strengths or what are the team members around me that can help, you know, move this thing forward, as opposed to, oh my gosh, like we're, you know, I don't know, the next war or whatever.
Yeah, the world's like, caving in. Sure.
I mean, there are real problems, but I can't fix it. So
yeah, it doesn't mean you don't care, right? It's right, just you don't want to get caught up in it. And I agree with you. I'm not a big news person. It doesn't mean I don't, you know. But here's what's funny. You hear about the stuff anyway, right? So it's kind of
right. Yeah, it's gonna
find its way to you anyhow. It might be a day later or something.
No, but you're right about the point of, you know, you can't, you probably shouldn't get into business if you're not willing to lose a, you know, lose money, business or investing, because you're going to take your licks if you do enough deals, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, the kind of the way, I mean, think about it. I'm not saying I want to be, you know, not care about the investors or money or anything, sure. But I also don't want to live a life of regret either. And it doesn't mean you're going to do things foolishly, but I think you have to. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? You know, I don't know that you'll be where I was when I was 8.
Right.
I doubt it. You know, and and the other thing is, even if you made your first million or whatever, 10 million, 100 million, you're not going to forget that, as long as you have your mental capacities, right? You can lose everything tomorrow. You're going to know how to go back and do it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of, it's like, I don't even worry about that kind of thing, you know, like I don't worry about money or anything. Like,
Well, that it really is the, even if this happens, I can still point to my strengths.
Just reinvent yourself and go back to whatever.
So then before I get to some questions I have here. So you mentioned being a real estate agent for a while. You mentioned the painting business, you mentioned contracting. And then you mentioned the kind of the distressed debt space. Obviously, that's what PPR is known for. And then you've gotten into more kind of commercial real estate more recently and that type of thing. Have we checked all the boxes as far as the businesses you've started?
Yeah. I mean, the only weird thing about PPR really was it was an accidental business. It wasn't like there was a robust business plan. It wasn't like I bought a franchise.
Well, no, that's actually talk about that, because, you know, I think that does hold a lot of entrepreneurs back, because they think they need this 10-year, 20-year vision and they don't take the next step.
Well, we actually have a 10-year vision now.
Okay, well, you do now.
Just to make people feel a little better. But in the very beginning, you know, it was, you know, I remember meeting with my partner, John, you know, I think we were at lunch in the area, you know, and it was almost like the back of a napkin type idea. Like he knew I raised money for commercial real estate before PPR. He's like, hey, why don't you raise money and I'll work the notes. And we actually had a short sale company. And the sign on the front of the building was the short sale company. And the short sale company went out of business. And then the notes were like in the back office and in one room, and that business kind of took off. And, you know, it started out with our own money at first. And, you know, I was really an investor in the beginning. It was pretty cool to have cash flow without tenants and things like that. Yeah. And it's passive, somewhat passive. Yeah. So that part was intriguing and compelling and all. And then the fact that you could buy something at a discount with a high yield with collateral was kind of appealing, right? So, you know, that's kind of what drew us in.
Yeah. Yeah. But so you kind of stumbled into it, and then it sounds like probably the market conditions helped.
Yeah. And then, you know, another thing that was adverse in the beginning, we started in an up market. And it was very scary because the market really crashed and all the equity fell out of your portfolio. So all of a sudden, you know, I forget how many million assets we had at the time, but all of a sudden the equity went away. So you're like, oh my gosh, if you had a bank mentality, you'd be like, we're done. Screwed. We're toast.
Yeah.
And what we found was that's not what happened, because equity didn't indicate outcome, and we weren't in a fire sale situation. So we're working through the assets.
Sure.
And what we learned was, as we bought new assets at better pricing, you know, it was funny with the equity assets at the time, we were getting out of, I don't know, let's say it was 9 out of 10. When we were buying assets with less equity or negative equity, we were getting out of, call it 7 out of 10, right? But we were paying a third for the assets of what we were paying, right? So that data, that actually thing that, you know, when the sky was falling or we thought the sky was falling, was a blessing in disguise, because we grabbed data that enabled us to go out and buy what no one else wanted to buy, right? It was kind of like a, you know, it reminded me when we would buy bankruptcy assets, the bank looks at them all as they're all bad and they put them in a bucket. We know statistically a third of them are good, and it's just which third. You know, it was a very statistical business when we started. We were in junior leans when we started, but you know, it was kind of interesting how that evolved. But that traumatic event of the market crashing, the equity falling, oh my gosh, the world's coming to an end.
Right.
You guys, the portfolio is worthless. Yeah, it's worthless if you're forced to sell it, but we weren't.
And in fact,
there's a lesson in that. Like, everybody tends to go to the worst case scenario all the time, but that's not always what dictates outcome, right?
So sure. Well, and I know being
you're seeing that in this market with mark to market on assets, you know, the mark to market valuations in the tank doesn't really mean anything unless you're selling it today, at a fire sale price, right?
So. Yeah, people say that with the stock market. Oh, I've lost all this money. It's like, well, no, you actually haven't. It's just that the number on the piece of paper says you have. So, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean,
I'm not saying you want to be in that situation,
right? But you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm in the NPL space, you know, as well. And if you can buy at a much better price point, you have a lot more options, and you can even, you know, it just gives you a lot more control and a lot more room for profit and a little bit more room for error, if you will. But
well, the pricing can adjust, and you can adjust your tactics too, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a, you know, in an up market where equity's up, you know, deed and lieu could be popular. In a down market when there's no equity, deed and lieu's a bad idea. I mean, so it's
absolutely.
If you don't adjust, then you know, it's almost like I don't say shame on you, but it's kind of like you need to adjust. Yeah. You know?
So, when you looking back, I mean, did you, as far as your business approach, your approach to all these businesses, at what point did you say, okay, I want you know, these are all going to be kind of spokes on a wheel. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but did you, when you were starting out as an agent, I'm assuming you didn't know you'd have all these different types of related businesses, or have started them at some point. So was there a point where you said, okay, kind of residential and even commercial real estate is my focus, and I'm going to start a title business, and all, or did it kind of just happen as you went along?
Well, at first it was like, I think I saw Robert Allen speak, and he was pitching a book, Multiple Streams of Income or something at the time.
Yep.
I was like, yeah, I can do that. I'm going to have, but what you quickly realize, it's not focused then, you know, and now you're doing a bunch of things. How well are you doing then? And you can only do them as good as you can handle it or something. And then the wheels start to fall off. So I don't know that I would do that again. I'm probably better off. And you see that today with a lot of real estate teams. You'll see the teams of real estate people who probably maybe have done better than me, even, because they might get someone that's an expert in listing versus an expert in selling, or an expert in property management. Sometimes I think it pays to drill down and really get something honed, whatever that expertise is. I'm not saying I'm not prescriptive or anything. I'm more like, I don't know. I think you might be better off doing what you do best and then bring in everyone else. I mean, it's kind of what I've done in this situation with us bringing in a new CEO. It's someone that came from a much larger, you know, $1.3 trillion under management over the last 29 years, who really scaled a company from around 150-ish employees to like 4,000, you know. Not saying we want that many people, but you get the idea. Am I the best person to wear all these hats and continue? You know, I've kind of taken it this far, but in some ways we're like a 15-year-old startup when you come into this scale. Like, if you really want to scale this thing, maybe it's better if I get out of the way and just do what I do best, which is usually more on the capital side than it is trying to be all these other things.
Sure. Yeah. And I do, it sounds like over the last few years, even before the very recent changes, sounds like PPR had already shifted toward focusing more on raising capital as opposed to managing assets. Is that true?
A very safe assessment. I mean, for many years, we were asset managers. We still are in some cases, in some areas. But the percentage is shrinking dramatically and a lot is outsourced. But the good news is it's different when you're outsourcing it and you've done it versus I outsourced it out, outsource it and I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people don't know, like even in multifamily, a lot of people don't know that I raised capital previously for commercial real estate. And they also don't know that I was a contractor in commercial real estate.
Right. Right.
And that I used to work in multifamily, 400 to 600 unit people were my customers. I used to do the turnovers. So it's a little different when you go to look at assets and feasibility of the projects and value add and things like that. New development. I was a guy that read blueprints and did estimates and all that stuff that I didn't realize would come in handy later. Kind of ironic how that works out sometimes that even my job in fast food, you know, I was a fast food manager, you know, when I was 18. You don't realize, you might go, you know, if I said that to my grandson who's 17, he'd be like, oh, I don't want to work there. But he doesn't realize you still learn systems, processes, checklists, all these things, you know, how to open the store, how to close the books, how to do inventory, how to do this. Even though you're at a fast food place, right? So there's a lot of lessons that you're picking up at these various jobs, you know, whether you're a self-employed contractor or whatever that is, that come along the way that become valuable later, even though they may not appear to be related, you know?
Yeah, they're still transferable skills. And,
transferable.
Absolutely. No, that's great. So yeah, it's probably pretty tough for these operators to and syndicators and different people, partners you're working with, for them to pull the wool over your eyes at this point, since you've got got a lot of experience in a lot of different areas. So
it's still a team sport, in fairness. Sure. I'm not trying to act like a know-it-all or anything.
Right.
It's you know, there's areas that, you know, maybe I'm not the greatest underwriter or whatever. There's probably people, you know, better at it than me or various parts of the business, right? I'm not an engineer, right? I'm not going to pretend to be one, right? So there's people on you know, on teams that are very helpful. Could be on the legal side, could be, you know, so the thing about commercial is it's definitely a team sport. There's plenty of room for multiple players on the team, you know?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. No, I mean, we own some rentals and I always recommend people, investors, manage their own properties first. If it's, every situation is different, of course, but if my property manager is really dropping the ball, I'm going to know it.
And you got to jump in anyway, right? So it's
like, but I'm going to fire off a few questions here and then we'll wrap it up.
Oh boy.
So what's one thing that people misunderstand about you, Dave?
Misunderstand about me. That's a good one. Jeez, I've never been asked that one. What do they misunderstand about me? Oh, maybe sometimes I'm being sarcastic, maybe.
Okay.
They don't know it.
They don't pick up. Yeah, I get that one too. Because I you know, I can be a little dry with my delivery. So it's like, hey, I'm going to be sarcastic.
Mean that, or is he,
That was a joke. I can.
They don't get my bad jokes all the time.
Yeah, so that's good. What's one of your biggest regrets, failures? I know you don't want to use that term necessarily, but, you know, something that you'd like a do-over with.
It would probably utilizing that leverage idea sooner and younger than I did. You know, I was, and then trying to be good at a lot of things, you know.
Sure.
Like, I'm never going to be that good at playing the guitar or speaking French or probably even golf, you know, like, so why do I too much energy or effort in some of these places or something, you know, when I could do something else or you get the idea.
Yeah.
Or do I just focus on what I'm really good at and just go knock it out of the park? You know, there's something to be said for some of that. No, I don't mean don't ever try to improve yourself. I don't mean that, but I think there's some truth to that, you know?
Yeah. And that goes hand in hand with the leverage, because the more
we
focus,
waste a lot of time, I think, trying to do mediocre crap. Right.
Yeah. Makes sense. If you could have coffee or drink with any historical figure, who would you choose? They could still be alive today if you choose.
That's a good one. Jesus, maybe.
That's a good one. I like it. Yeah.
I don't know if you drank coffee, but maybe wine.
Maybe wine. But, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many historical people. That's a good question. There's so many. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to beat the Jesus answer. if you were given $10 million tomorrow, not saying you don't already have $10 million, but if you were, somebody wrote $10 million check just to
an
you,
extra 10.
An extra 10. What would you do with it?
You know, it's funny you say that because I'm at a point in my life where it's like, you know, it's funny. One of the books I just read was The Second Mountain. And, you know, it's
I'm literally reading.
It's a good book, right?
It's great.
And I read that this year. I read quite a bit, but a lot of it's been around, you know, what's your next? What's, you know, I don't like the word retirement, but it's really, you know, what do you want to do next? What's more impactful, maybe? How can I do bigger things? And, if you gave me $10 million, it would not materially impact my life right now. Hmm. And I don't mean that in a bad way or a snotty way.
Well, I was going to, but I'm not going to now. So I'm kidding. So, I was going to give you $10 million.
So I would probably be looking at, you know, what could I do pretty good with this that would be interesting, as opposed to some of the other folks. I mean, I'm sure everybody sees a lot of nonsense on different media channels of jumping in front of, you know, private this and jets and this and yachts and all. That's just not me.
Sure.
I know some people are, that's their thing. That's great. But right. I just, because I always feel like maybe it's because of where I came from, that I just feel like, no, I can help a lot of people with some of that, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just, it's more rewarding for me to give than to get in a lot of cases.
I love it. Yeah, real quick anecdote on the Second Mountain book. Somebody was messaging me a few weeks ago, and she said, because she always asks for book recommendations at the end of the year, and we put out a list of from all of our podcast guests. We said these are the book recommendations, and so she's messaging me, and she says, "This book is amazing. I've got to give you so much credit. It was you who recommended this." And I said, "Confession, I haven't read that one. That was actually, it was Mark Podolsky."
Well, it's hard to read them all, isn't it? Yeah.
So, yeah. So now I'm reading it because I feel obligated, but it's really good.
Yeah, it is good.
Now, I know you have a book you've already written. What's the name of that book, Dave?
Real Estate Note Investing.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
If you had to write another book this year, what would that be about?
You know, it's interesting. Obviously, I raise a lot of capital, so that could be an interesting book. A lot of people want you to write a book on how to work with notes, which is a, you know, that's more of a ops thing or more of a, and I'm not really the ops person either, but yeah, you could do that. And what other books could you give? That's a good question. Probably scaling a business or something, you know, that kind of thing. Or right now, I'm like big into the board and the formation of really elevating the company and professionalizing the business and, you know, doing a gap analysis on like what board of advisors or board of directors, in my case, can really elevate the company and really take us to another level. And I think that, you know, that's something I look back on and that I should have done sooner, especially with, even if I couldn't afford board of directors, board of advisors sooner, like what was I thinking waiting? And, you know, it's crazy that we wait. You know?
So for somebody who's got a company that's a lot smaller than yours, how would they, is it EOS or what would you recommend as far as,
I mean, that's a good place to start. I mean, any of those types of outfits where, you know, there's a, you know, a dozen CEOs or whatever, they can be your board of directors too. You can actually get one. I just think they just don't stop their day to think about, you know, the advisors they could bring in. And even if you can't pay, you know, you can always, do a combination of, you know, modest compensation versus, you know, sliver of equity or something. Really, they're a board of advisors till there's equity involved. If there's equity, regardless of what you call them, well, once there's equity involved, then they're typically a board of directors. And then they, you know, they're really, they have resources and network that you just don't have in areas that you don't have. And you can really, you know, catapult your business with some real strategic advice with someone that has a vested interest in helping you to do that. So it's like anything. I strongly recommend that to folks that they probably, I mean, I was guilty of it. I waited and dilly-dallied and, you know, didn't do it and look back and go, what were you thinking? You know, like,
well, it's back to that. It's the leverage piece that you were already talking
or
about.
Or we just, I don't know what it is. We just don't realize that how much that can benefit us, you know, because it really only takes a couple relationships or a couple of resources that could dramatically uptick the business. You know, a lot of, I see a lot of businesses, they get to a certain stage and then they get stuck, you know, and it's like something's going to get them unstuck, you know, and a lot of times it is these types of advisors, you know.
Well, it does take discipline, mental discipline to stop, because there's always a fire to put out, like you alluded to earlier. It's just stop and create that space to work on the business. It's easier said than done. But what's one, I guess, one thing about your, looking back at your career, one thing that that you didn't expect, kind of a big surprise in your industry, if you will?
Well, Dodd-Frank was a big
one.
You know, when we first started in the distressed debt space, it was a little bit of the Wild West, so you had a lot of freedom.
Sure.
And then that regulatory environment really got pretty stifling. What I didn't expect? That's a good question. Well, we also pivoted, right? So I didn't expect COVID. That was something I didn't expect. So things like those types of small little black swan events like that can, you know, but, you know, the good news is that, you know, if you have your act together and, you know, you can get through certain things, you know, it's just a testament to the team or the company, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The one thing I did learn there is that we weren't as much as the issue as the government. They didn't handle the pivot very well.
Oh,
and you can see that with, well, let's just take courthouse recording, right? I mean, half the counties aren't even online, right? So that's
ridiculous.
Besides that being a disgrace, that's a structural problem. It's probably still in effect, like where they're still.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in Pennsylvania, there's something like 67 counties or something. There's like 12 online, you know? It's like,
it's crazy.
Really? Like, do you realize the internet's here, you know?
Well, that and the whole execution of like the PPP loan program, but that's a whole other story,
right? But what my point was, it wasn't so much that we couldn't get through the, it's just you didn't have any support from the systems that you had to rely on just by the nature of the business. So it was almost like their lack of readiness almost put additional parties. I'm sure they did. I'm sure they put other companies out of business.
Sure. Just a few more quick questions here.
Yeah, sure.
How has financial abundance made your life better?
Probably peace of mind. You know, I never really worry about money. I don't know if it's a case of, because I hadn't come from a lot, you know, like it's, so I never really worry about it. And I always, you know, obviously I believe in a higher power and things like that, but I do have that kind of mentality where, you know, I'll just figure it out. I know that things will be okay, you know, kind of thing. So I don't, you know, it's like Tony Robbins probably said it best. We don't lack resources. We lack resourcefulness.
I love it.
And I like that. I like that. I like that line. Like, it, you know, it's like the acres of diamonds. They're all right in front of us, you know? And I believe that with anything as simple as nature. Like I like to read, you know, like on a beach or in the mountains on a deck or, you know, like I like to be near nature. I feel close to God or the universe, whatever that is for folks. And, you know, one of the things is there's no bad nature or whatever, you know, normally, unless it's a tornado or something.
Sure.
I mean, there's beautiful places, you know, a lot of times you'll see people say, well, this place is more beautiful than this place. I'm like, yeah, maybe today it is. But, you know, there's plenty of beauty in the world. There's plenty of, you know, we don't necessarily have to go 10,000 miles to find something beautiful. It might be right in front of our backyard or something, you know? So it's a, that's my view on that. I mean, it's weird, but
no, it's not weird. It's great.
Beauty's all around us, right? So
absolutely. Just two more questions here. How do you like to serve others?
Yeah, that's a good question. For a long time, my oldest son was in recovery and me and him had owned a drug and alcohol recovery center for 11 years. And nowadays he still owns one, but it's mainly because I was going off to do other things and things mm-hmm. like that. So that was very rewarding. And then we do a lot of charitable stuff, mostly on the homelessness side. I've done a lot with Project Home, which is in Philadelphia. So that's been, you know, housing related, maybe just because mm-hmm. of the nature of all the businesses I had were housing related. Sure. And, you know, I always like, you know, I always, I really believe that the homeless problem we have is not really being addressed very well. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I look in other countries, you know, that don't really have it the way we do, like whether I'm in mm-hmm. the Netherlands or somewhere else, I'm like, you know, why are we so messed up here? Mm-hmm. So I do look to that, and there's a lot of reasons, obviously, but the I just think there can be more work done, and you know, there's some smart people that could put their heads together and help try to solve some of it anyway.
Sure. Those are some very important causes, and I'd like to highlight that since I do believe entrepreneurship is a force for good, and you know, you've shown you can create wealth in your own life and make a very positive impact for others. So that's really good. Last question, where can our listeners find you online? Sounds like they can't call you.
Can't call me. No, I don't mean it that way. That sounds pretty bad. No, you can reach me at PPR, capitalmanagement.com, but the management is MGMT.com. Or you can reach me on Bigger Pockets. We also have a distress mortgages group on LinkedIn. People ask questions periodically, especially on Bigger Pockets. We answer a lot of stuff for basically anything, and we try to answer them, you know, almost daily. We answer stuff. So yeah, feel free to reach out. Always there to help other investors. I do believe that. And I do like what you said earlier. If you can think of ways to be more impactful in your investing, by all means, right? It's pretty easy if you think about it to go out and, you know, we have a lot of things. We're fortunate. We're in a great place, a great country, things like that. We have a lot of resources that a lot of other folks in other places don't have. And it's just to be mindful that, you know, we can, you know, we don't always have to do this take mentality. We can, there's plenty that we can do to give back and have an impact. I really encourage people to think about doing more impactful investing than just investing. You know?
I love it. And it's really gets to the abundance mindset and abundance approach that you clearly have. And that, you know, that we're trying to highlight on the show. So this has been fantastic, Dave. I really appreciate your time. So thanks a lot for joining us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you, Jamie. Take care.
Absolutely.
Now.
Yeah. And to our listener out there, thank you for spending your most valuable resources with us. And that is your time. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversitytoabundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bateman, and I'm thrilled to offer you something special today: the power of mortgage note investing. This exclusive 5-chapter, 74-page ebook is packed with insights, strategies, actionable tips, and case studies to help you navigate the world of mortgage note investing with confidence. Whether you're just starting out or you're looking to refine your expertise, this ebook will be your go-to guide for building wealth and achieving financial freedom. The best part? It's completely free. Sign up now to claim your copy and take the first step toward mastering mortgage note investing. Don't miss this chance to gain the knowledge and tools you need to succeed. Visit LabradorLending.com and start your journey today.